The Bible indicates was a man after God's own heart. And I guess there are just so many things about David that made him that it's hard to cover all of them. But you look at David's life, and during his lifetime, he was actually an adulterer, a liar, a deceiver, and a murderer. And yet, while I was this afternoon down at the jail, and I was talking to some of the inmates, I told them, I said, you know, I said, a lot of you guys in prison can be murderers and liars and thieves and adulterers, but I said, there's really not a whole lot of difference between you and the people that are outside. The people outside either control their carnal natures or got saved and responded to God's Spirit, and they've got their carnal natures under control. David was a man who sinned, but who God forgave, because David was a kind of a man who would always go back and ask God for forgiveness. But one of the traits we're going to look at here, where you all stopped last week, is the fact that David was always anxious to stand up for the Lord. He was always anxious to stand up when something was happening that tended to belittle God in man's eyes. And it really bothered him. It wasn't put on. He really didn't like to see anything go on that caused anyone to think less of God. And so he was a constant person who, and he put his life on the line. He was a warrior. He was a man who didn't seem to mind a good fight as long as what he did was on the side of right. Now in 1 Samuel 17:28, where you all left off, "And Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, Why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle." Now this was the oldest of David's brothers, and brothers have a tendency to know each other. They also have a tendency to be jealous of one another. But they also know each other's characteristics. I can't prove it from this single statement, but I imagine that David's character, as far as worshiping God and having confidence in God and continually making statements like, "Why are we running from these Philistines? Why are we letting these Philistines overcome us? Why are we afraid of the Philistines? Why do we give up our lands? We're God's people. We should fight for these things." I can't prove that David said that. But I believe that if you go through and look at what David said after this and what David did, I imagine he had actually experienced that many times around his brothers, and Eliab knew his character. And so what he's really probably doing here is saying, "You little rascal, you didn't come down here for the right reason. You just came down here because you wanted to see this, because this is what you're always talking about, and you wanted to see this battle." Well, what Eliab didn't know is what you studied last week, where actually the father of all these brothers and David's father, Jesse, had deliberately sent him down to take some food and some favors to the captain over the particular group, 100, that Eliab and his brothers were in. And so David had a good reason for coming. But notice David didn't say, "Hey, look, you dummy, Dad sent me down here, and I came down here, and look at the thanks I get." Because if you remember what you studied last week, David was delighted when he saw all his brothers and that they were well. But he didn't defend himself. Notice what he did. And David said, "What have I now done? Is there not a cause?" And what he is saying here, in essence, is, "What's the matter with you? Don't you realize that there's a cause here now?" He had just been informed, as had all the Israelites, of Goliath, the Philistine giant. And they were scared to death of this Philistine giant. And so would you and I have been afraid of him. Now, if you look at what Josephus said, he said he was between 8 and 9 feet tall. If you take the temple cubit, he was between 10 and 11 feet tall. If you take the standard cubit, Goliath was between 9 and 10 foot tall. I really suspect he was about 9.5 or 9 to 10 feet tall. But he was a gigantic man. And apparently he was not like one of these Ugandan tribes that is real thin. He was just a huge man. And you would have been scared to death if you had seen him. And now David is saying to his brother, "Look, there's a cause here. We ought to be upset about this. This Philistine giant is coming out every day, and I think it said he had come out for 40 days, but I'm not sure of that. And he had come out, and every time he had ridiculed Israel and said, "What's the matter with you cowards? Won't some man come out and fight me?" And David was right. He was saying, "What's the matter with you? Is there not a cause?" But he didn't stop there. And he turned from him toward another. And he said to another, and spake after the same manner. He said, "Is there not a cause?" And the people answered him again after the former matter. And apparently, David just kept doing this from one to one. He said, "What's the matter? Is there not a cause here? Are you letting this Philistine giant run all over you? What's the matter with you?" And when the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul. It apparently started spreading from group to group, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him." What he said, in essence, to Saul, was what he'd already said. Is there not a cause? Israel was scared to death of this giant Goliath, and they had lost sight of who their God was. Their God was the God who parted the waters of the Red Sea. Their God was the God who led them through the Sinai. Their God was the God who had caused water to come out of the rock. He had performed many miraculous works, but the problem wasn't that he hadn't performed these works. It's that when they were told about them, they didn't really believe them, because Israel's cause was right. They knew it. And yet they would not go out against this giant. They rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Thou art not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth." Now, it all depends on who you read after. I think Josephus makes him very young, but I believe he was probably about 15 years old. Now, 15 years old doesn't seem very old, but at 15, you've got an awful lot of muscle. You've got an awful lot of energy, and you don't get tired very easily. And so 15 is not what you would call an undesirable age. You're quick. You've got most of your manhood development, and you can run and still not get tired. You've got a lot of your youthful zeal. And David said unto Saul, "Thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock." Now, Saul is telling him, "I'm sorry, you cannot go and fight this Philistine. This Philistine has been a warrior from his youth, and you're just a little old young boy, and you're going out against a full-grown man who's been that way from his youth." Now, David's got to convince him that he can do it, and that he has a background that will allow him to do it. "And there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb from the flock, and I went after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. When he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him." Now, I don't mean to take anything away from what David did. And if this had been a full-grown, bored African lion, David would have done the same thing, and the result would have been the same. But this was, no doubt, a Persian lion. And the Persian lion is not like your mighty African lion. He's got a mane, a beard. It comes down really more like a beard than a mane. It's a real short mane, and it comes down in the form of a beard. They're not nearly as powerful as the African lion. And usually, even with sheep, they're like more like a small puma. They try to catch the sheep more by cunning than by overpowering them. And when they catch one, they grab it and run with it like mad for a long time, hoping to get away from the individual who is hurting the actual flock. So this would not have been as great accomplishment had it been a full-grown African lion. But believe me, it's a tremendous accomplishment. Apparently, he caught this lion, grabbed it by the beard, may have straddled the thing, and probably beat it to death with a club on his head. The shepherds carried the Irish call a shillelagh stick, and probably beat him in the head and crushed his brains out and delivered it out of his mouth. When he kept hitting him in the head, he dropped the lamb. "And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him." Now, it gives the impression that he came upon him, which may have been the case. But in any case, he grabbed him by his beard, probably got on his back, probably hit him in the head and beat him to death, and he may have dropped the lamb when David first came up. You can't tell, but anyway, that's quite a feat. He also did the same thing with the bear. The bear rose up, and he apparently did the same thing with the bear. Now, a shepherd carried what looked like a shillelagh stick. He also carried spears, and he also carried a sling. And with a lion and a bear, they normally use these pointed staves, or they use this shillelagh stick. "Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God." it really bothered David what this man had been allowed to do. Now, we live in a day, in a society, in a time when it doesn't seem to matter to people about a lot of things. David was more concerned about this than he was about his own family or his own life. This may not seem to you to be a valid comparison, but when the Lord delivered to his first New Testament church the ordinances they were supposed to observe, he made it very clear through the writings of Paul how they were supposed to be done and how they were supposed to be observed. When we don't do things the way God said, we defile the actual commandments of God. And today, there are very few people that are concerned about it. Today, we've got a religious fervor in this country that is more religious than Christian. It's more religious than truth. And people are doing things quite different from the way Christ said to do them in the church, and nobody seems to care. So David's attitude was right. He was concerned about the fact that people, that this Philistine was defiling God's army and God's people. David said, moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion, now the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of the Philistine. And Saul said unto David, go, and the Lord be with you. He convinced Saul. I think what convinced him was, God delivered him from a lion, he delivered him from a bear, and he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. At least Saul saw some hope there. This is something that I think doesn't change down through the ages. This was what made David, one of the things, a man after God's own heart. David knew his cause was right. Now, to be perfectly honest, there are times when I don't know if my cause is right. There are situations that come up in a church, different things happen with the members. Perfectly honest, I really at times don't know if I'm right or wrong. But when it comes to certain instructions that God gave us in the church, I know in most cases that I'm right. And if a person doesn't stand up for what's right, then he's making a serious mistake, because God will deliver him out of the hands of those who are opposed to what he's doing. If what God's word says is right, God wants men and women to stand up and stand for that, because the Lord will be with them. And David was a man who believed as long as he was doing what God wanted and was in the center of God's will, and it's perfectly obvious that he was here, that he wasn't afraid of anything. And Saul armed David with his armor, and he put a helmet of brass upon his head, and he armed him with a coat of mail. And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go, for he had not yet proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with thee, for I have not proved them. And David put them off of him. Now, it would have been logical to have completely covered yourself up against this giant. But David was a man who knew how to use what he had been trained in from his youth. And David was a man who realized, and this is the most important thing, you don't need a lot of fancy accoutrements. You don't need a lot of protective ingredients or elements in your stand for God. What you need to do is to be right, and God will take care of the rest. So David took all this armament off. It was probably too heavy for him anyway. And he took his staff in his hand. Now the staff had a club on the end, and it was like an Irish shillelagh. And on the end, it was a knotted club, and it could crush a man's skull or an animal skull. And chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook. Now, when John and I were in school in Little Rock, I never will forget this. A guy preached a message about why David chose these 5 smooth stones. And I even heard one of the teachers do this. And it really sounded great. Goliath did have 4 brothers. And I can prove that. And when I first came up here, I did point out to you guys that Goliath had 4 brothers. But that is absolutely ridiculous to believe that David went down there in a brook and picked out 5 stones because Goliath had 4 brothers. I'm sorry, that doesn't make a lick of sense. You say, well, this should have been that. No, come on, come on. David didn't know how many brothers he had. Back then, they didn't have computer analysis where Saul could sit in the tent and get a rundown on Goliath. And David just went down there and he happened to pick up 5. But somebody's always got to have some special significance to these numbers. And I've heard people say, well, he took five stones because five is the number of a cantaloupe or something like that. And they'll give you all this stuff. And it's like one time Joe Carlton and I were outside in the hall. What was this guy's name? James, what was James? You remember James Andrews. James Andrews was always, quote, looking for something to preach. And he came in and he said, Mac, Joe, he said, I got one. We said, well, what do you got? He said, you won't believe it. He said, do you know what it meant when Jesus sat down on the mount of sat down on the mountain there and gave the Beatitudes? And Joe said, no, I don't know what it meant when he sat down there. And I said, well, I don't know. He said, it meant the kingdom of God had sat down on the earth. And I'll never forget what Joe said next. He said, well, James, what did it mean when Jesus sat down on that ass and rode into Jerusalem? James said, well, so if you take and make something out of that, you can make some wonderful messages out of it, but they happen to be smooth stones because they came out of a brook, and I can assure you he went to the brook for that reason. When stones go down a brook carried by water over a long period of time, it breaks off all the rough edges. And David went down there to get a smooth stone because the shepherd's sling was about that long. It was fairly long. It had two thongs of leather on each side and had a leather pouch in the middle. And it was fairly long. It almost hit the ground when you went around with it because of the more centrifugal force you got. If you got an irregular stone in there, the weight was not even in the pouch, and you could miss your target. Now, the shepherds of that day, all they had to do, it was like when I was in Vietnam. There were some times we didn't have anything to do, and I had a .45. And when we didn't have anything to do and we were up in a particular position at night where we were in a fairly safe zone, I remember one time, for a long time, we got stuck in an old French, out in the middle of nowhere, in an old French deserted villa, and it was just all grown up, and it was awful, but it was a roof over our head, and it had lizards. The thing was just loaded with lizards. So I would sit and practice shooting those lizards off the wall. I had plenty of ammunition. And I got to where, at first, I was missing them. But after two or three nights, I was hitting them every time. Then that wasn't any fun. So I started shooting behind my back like this. And I'd practice shooting them behind my back like that. If you practice at anything long enough and hard enough, you can get good at it. And these shepherds, when they were out there with the sheep, they didn't have much to do most of the time. And so they'd practice with that thing. I mean, if you had one of those shepherds here now, and you told him you wanted to hit that number two on that clock back there, he could do it. So what David did was phenomenal, only in the sense that he's facing a guy that's probably a little over 9 feet tall, and your arm's not usually too steady when that's happening. But if you stop and think about it, Goliath had a helmet on, he had armor on, he had a shield. He only had one real open place you could get him, right here. And that was the one spot that David went for. That thing didn't go in there by accident. It wasn't a lucky shot. David had trained for years out in the wilderness. You say, well, now, wait a minute. God guided that stone. No, God guided him while he was training out in the wilderness. And God trained him out there so that when he came up against Goliath, God knew exactly where that stone was going to go because that old boy could hit anything. He could hit a gnat off a camel's head. Okay. And he took his staff in his hand and chose him five smooth stones out of the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had, even in a scrip. It was kind of a thing a shepherd carried around his shoulder like a Mexican bandera where they keep their ammunition. And his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. And the Philistine came on and drew near to David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was a youth and ruddy. Now, this means that he either had auburn hair or red hair. I don't know which, but ruddy means red. And a fair countenance. If you've ever looked at Tommy Brown, or if you've ever looked at look at Johnny. They've got light complexions, and their hair is kind of an auburn or red, and it's awfully hard to see a redhead with a dark complexion. And so David was apparently auburn hair or red hair, and he had a light complexion, probably the type. He probably had freckles, but I can't get all that from there. And the Philistine said unto David, am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And his god was Dagon. And Dagon had a whole court entourage of other gods, and so he cursed him by Dagon. and whatever else happened to be available at that time. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give thy flesh to the fowls of the air and the beasts of the field." Now, here is David, about 15 years old. He's got a club and a sling with five stones. And here's this guy. Lord have mercy. I'm 5'10". And that would put this guy up to the ceiling. And here he is, this guy, in full armor, and another club carrying his shield, which I guess he had handed Goliath the shield by this time. And for this little pipsqueak to say this is beyond imagination. I used to go up around with a little fellow named David Michaelis to work some. You remember this, Imogene. And he taught me how to win people in the front room. Oh, Lord. And we would go to a door, and David was a little scrawny fella. Lord have mercy, I'd make six of David. And we'd go to the door, and David would knock. And if some sweet little lady came in to the door, he'd say, "Do you know where you're going to spend eternity?" And we'd go to the next door. I don't care who came to the door. That's what he said. I'll never forget the first time we came to a door, and I'm standing there. I was the silent partner. I was supposed to keep the other person that was already saved occupied. I had the dummy role. This was many, many years ago. This guy comes to the door, and I can't even see the top of his head. All I see is an Adam's apple and a beard hanging down. And an undershirt, not a t-shirt, undershirt, and hair coming out of the top of that thing like this. And the smell, you could pick him up when he first opened the door. And in his right hand is a great big can of Slitz beer. And the guy's standing there, and that's David. And I'm thinking, "Oh, Lord, David, don't ask." And David said, "Sir, do you know where you're going to spend eternity?" And I'll never forget it, because I thought to myself, we are about to find out. But fortunately, the guy slammed the door in our face. So if you think I'm going to tell a victorious story, we're wearing the Lord, you can forget that. He slammed the door. And I know this sounds awful, but I was glad. Now, this is a little guy standing out there, and he said this. Then said David, "Philistine comest to me with a sword, with a spear, with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defiled." Now, when the Lord told you to turn the other cheek, he didn't tell you couldn't go to war. He didn't tell you that you shouldn't stand up for what's right in the world, and you shouldn't join the military, and you shouldn't fight against those people that are totally ungodly and trying to bring tyranny to other people across the earth. He didn't say that at all. And so as far as war is concerned, in this particular time, what they were doing was absolutely right. Now, this is not, David didn't go out there on the offense. And the Philistines were always attacking the Israelites. And they were always in a defensive posture against the Philistines. It was very rare that Israel ever attacked anybody, and down through history, it's always been that way. So they were on the defensive. And yet he goes out there and says this. I think the same thing holds true today. I think if the whole religious world gets to the point where they sacrifice the truth about the Lord's Supper, where they sacrifice the truth about baptism, where they sacrifice the truth about salvation, where they corrupt every teaching that Jesus left here, I think as long as we stand up and take a stand and tell them, "You're wrong, that's not right, here's what the Scripture says," I think God will deliver us. "This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee, and I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air, to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel." That was why David did this. David didn't like what he saw those people doing to ridicule God before Israel. And he didn't like what was happening to Israel, because it was taking all the spirituality out of Israel. "And all the assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear." Now he's talking about both sides, both the Philistines and the Israelis, but primarily with the Israelites. "For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." I think those few words right there, "For the battle is the Lord's," those six words, is something that every member of God's churches, and especially the pastors, need to learn. It's the Lord's battle. If you'll just do what God said, do it the way he said to do it, follow his instructions, be true to the way that he indicated certain things should be done in the church, give yourself to following the commandments of God and the truths of God, and don't compromise them, don't sacrifice them, God's going to take care of the battle. And God's going to be the one that wins the battle. It's not with how much might and power you've got. It's not with how much wisdom you've got. Not by might, not by power, but my spirit, saith the Lord. So, as a pastor of this church, I spend a lot of my time just trying to get people to try to do what God says about certain instructions He left us, with the understanding that God's going to take care of the battle, and the battle is one that goes on continuously, and it's not going to be finally settled until Jesus comes. And it came to pass, when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hastened and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone and slung it and smote the Philistine in his forehead. Now, this forehead, this Hebrew word that's used means eye socket. But I assume it means right between the eye socket, right in here, which is one of the most vulnerable places on a human being. And smote the Philistine in his forehead. And this is an interesting word here. Sunk. That the stone sunk into his forehead. This Hebrew word is definitive. It means like it sinks into water. And he gives a picture here of a stone hitting this place. And just like you throw a stone in water and it disappears in the water and you don't see the stone anymore, apparently the velocity with which it struck the Philistine right here, it went so far in that you couldn't even see the stone anymore. Now you can get tremendous velocity with these shepherd slings. And David apparently got pretty close to the booger. And he let that thing go, and it apparently sunk in so far that you couldn't even see the stone. And he fell upon his face to the earth. It means he just went straight forward. Now, I think the one thing, if you read this narrative very carefully, the thing that really bothered David was the effect this was having on God's people. Now, God had already anointed, I think David was concerned about his people. I think he was concerned about the fact that here was a Philistine army that was making fun of God. It was tearing down the spirituality of his people. The people were losing confidence in God. Here's a little 15-year-old boy, and God takes him and does that, and notice the effect it had on the people. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling with a stone and smote the Philistine and slew him, but there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of the sheath thereof and slew him and cut off his head therewith. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. And here's what David was after. And the men of Israel of Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until thou came to the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way to Shaaraim, even unto Gath and unto Ekron. And the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistine, and they spoiled their tents. Now, I am a man who spends a great deal of his time trying never to give even the slightest hint that God's word is not reliable. It is, 100%. But I'm also a man who is put to the test of always being honest about something. And when I come to something like this, I need to be honest, and I need to show you there are choices here, because these subjects come up. Verse 54. You got a real problem here. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem. No. Not at that time. Because Jerusalem was still in the hands of the Jebusites. David was not yet king of Israel. That was many years away. And it took David over 7 years to conquer Jerusalem, the Jebusite. So there is no question that this writer here is, this is called a proliferite, I believe. It's where you say something, you're writing about something that happened in the past, and all of it happened in the past, but you don't pay much attention to the time when something happened. I think this happened many years later. Now, there was a common practice. I know that we think that taking the heads of missionaries and other Indians in South America and going through a process of actually mummifying them and keeping them outside on a rail outside of your abiding, your dwelling place, is cannibalistic and terrible and probably just limited to that area. But they had a habit in those days, not the Israelites particularly, but the Philistines and others, of cutting off a man's head, going through a mummification process, and keeping it for years. So it's very possible that what this is talking about is that David took the head of this Philistine, and later on, after Jerusalem became the city of David, after he conquered the Jebusite kingdom and the city of Jerusalem, that then he brought the head down. The second thing is, and he put his armor in his tent. David didn't have a tent at that time. David had just come down. He hadn't a tent to live in. And so this is probably referring to a time when he came to Jerusalem after he had conquered it, and he put the armor in his tent there, and the head was brought from somewhere else. Now, there's another problem in verses 55 to 58. If you go back in your narrative, David had already come, and David had already played for Saul. Go back and look in the chapters before this. And you've already read it and talked about it and studied it here on Wednesday night. And you know that when an evil spirit possessed Saul, that David came and played for him. And David playing the harp, or the lyre, whatever it was he played, that soothed the evil spirit in Saul, and it calmed him, and he recovered. So when it talks about what you see in verses 55 to 58, it doesn't make sense. And when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he said unto Abner, the captor of the host, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As thy soul liveth, O king, I cannot tell." Now, Saul should have already known this, because in the previous chapters that you've studied, even when David was much, much younger, he came. And the king said, "Inquire thou whose son this stripling is." And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son art thou, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of thy servant Jesse the Bethlehemite." Now there is a solution to this. Perhaps in the eastern court, when you brought in someone to play the harp, they sat on the far, in the court of the king, and even an Israelite king, was fairly long. It was a very long tent. And the harpist would come and sit in one corner and play. And he may never have really paid a whole lot of attention to who was playing the instrument. That's possible. Also, David, when he played for him, long before this, was much younger. By this time, as was the case with most Israelites, when they were 15, some of them started growing a beard. David may have had a beard. So there are a lot of answers to this. Now, I'm not suggesting that this has to be the truth, but I do want to tell you this. Right here, at the end of verse 53, in the Vatican document, which is the oldest document we have of the Pentateuch, verses 54 onward are not in it. So that may have been added by some well-meaning scribe or Pharisee, but I doubt that. I think what happened was simply this. This was meant to be put in, but it was put in telling something that was going to happen in the future, and as an afterthought of something that happened that was probably put in later. And probably David was so young when he played for Saul, if you go back and look at it, that Saul no longer recognized him. And so that's probably the solution to this. But I said I have to be honest with you and tell you that from 54 on, it's not in the oldest document we have. And that may have been added in by some well-meaning scribe. But whether it was added in or not, there's no problem with it. There are about four or five different solutions, but it's 820, and all of them are good solutions. But the main thing that I wanted to really make in this particular section of Scripture, you know, times change, children's change, parents change, civilization changes, everything changes. But there's one thing that doesn't change: God's principles. And God put us down here for a purpose. And after our forefather Adam sinned, we all inherited a nature where we couldn't carry out that purpose, no matter how hard we tried. That's why God gave us His Spirit, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. God by His Spirit guided men. It was the Spirit of God that guided David. It was the Spirit of God that led David. And David responded to God's Spirit. Now, every one of you here are professed born-again believers. And every one of you have the same God that David had. God doesn't change. God's principles don't change. Now, we're facing a situation now where we have a very religious fervor in this country. We've got an awful lot of people that are suddenly getting religious. The problem is they're following Benny Hinn, they're following these freaks on television. And we look at that stuff and we laugh. But do you know the vast bulk of many of the preachers today are just can't wait to get on that Trinity Broadcast Network so they can get themselves in front of the American public? And I tell you what, you cannot serve God and mammon. Now, you can accuse me of many things, but I have not served God for this. And if you watch those fellas, what comes out of their mouth says one thing, but their conduct and their actions say another. And when I see a man who claims to be a Baptist on a program with Benny Hinn, telling Benny Hinn what a great person he is, and how much he appreciates and respects his word, when I know that the conduct and actions and the things that Benny Hinn are doing are directly contradictory to God's word, and when they join in with those charlatans, I see an end time scenario that's just exactly like Jesus said. Jesus said, when the Son of Man cometh, will he find faith on the earth? And the word for faith, in front of it has the definite article. It isn't translated, but it's there. Will the Son of Man find thee faith on the earth? I'm not a Baptist because my forefathers were. I'm not a Baptist just because of the name B-A-P-T-I-S-T. I'm only a Baptist because we believe in salvation by grace. We believe in security of the believer. We believe in baptism by immersion by the authority of the local church. We believe in the Lord's Supper as a closed ordinance to the church. And we believe the church is local and visible. And quite frankly, that's what Baptists have already believed, always believed. One of the great tragedies of our age is what has happened to many Baptist churches. As far as I know, we are the only Baptist church in Dardanelle, Arkansas, that is still practicing closed communion. And these other Baptist churches will tell us, what's the matter with you? Don't you love people? Don't you care people? You roll this clock back to the year 1900. You roll it back to 1900, and all the Southern Baptist churches practice closed communion. Does that mean for 1900 years the Baptists were wrong? Does that mean they were wrong? And does that mean that God meant for us after 1900 to change to this new procedure? No. It means that for the sake of compromise, being more concerned about what people think than what God thinks, we're compromising everything. And the truth of the matter is, Jesus told his disciples, he said, think not that I am come to send peace upon the earth, for I am come to set son against father, and father against son, and mother against daughter, and daughter-in-law against mother, and father against son, and son-in-law. He indicated that in the last days there'd be some hard choices to make. I made my choices, and I've made my stand. I became a child of God 50 years ago. I became a Baptist 11 years later. And I'm going to die a Baptist believing what the Baptist forefathers before me believed, because nobody ever had a right to change it. In these last days, you're going to suffer criticism. And I warn you that you're going to have people look at you and laugh at you and say, what do you mean? And there's going to be a tremendous temptation to say, well, you know, maybe that little bunch down there at that church, maybe they are wrong. Maybe they're just kind of gone off the deep end. We haven't gone off the deep end. They've gone off the deep end, and they don't want to admit it. I would to God that they will, but I guarantee you it's going to get worse. We're the only Baptist church in Dardanelle, Arkansas, that's still practicing closed communion. You go back to when the First Baptist Church down here was first started. That's where a lot of these churches came out of. John will tell you that. And they practiced closed communion. When I first came to this town, they were still practicing closed communion. So were they wrong for all those years? But everybody says, you mean you want to shut people out of the Lord's Supper? No. The Lord indicated the ones who should take it were his children that coveted together in a local place to take it. We don't want to shut Jesus out of it. You can shut Jesus out of it by violating it and doing it differently from what Jesus said. So I hope you'll keep that in mind, and it's 2 minutes until 8:30, so